You're listening to Resolution Radio. Radio. ResolutionRDO.com.
Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. Is there really such a thing as a half-Jew? I suppose so, but it seems to me that part of the survival strategy of the apex parasite is to blend races, the hosts to weaken our defenses, but also to blend the Jew's own race in order to blur the lines of distinction between them and us, creating psychological confusion and weakness of the trigger finger. And they've been doing just that for uncounted centuries, while still retaining a genetic spiritual core that is distinctly them. It is both mental, spiritual, and usually physically visible in their faces, once one becomes attuned and sensitive to the differences, to their wavelength. Such mixing with their hosts exposes them to the danger that some of their offspring will not have the distinctive Jewish mentality to a high enough degree to enthusiastically engage in or support predation on their hosts. A few may even possess a mentality that, Aryan-like, is disgusted by such predation and the multiform deceptions that make it possible. And there have been a few Jewish defectors who were probably examples of this. Their writings are sometimes useful. Yet, the Jews don't seem to produce too many like this. Much larger in number, probably, are the ones who, finding Jewish identity and practices uncongenial, despite great monetary and practical advantages, just quietly fall away from the tribe. This, as I have pointed out before, results in a genetically transmitted, ever-intensifying Jewish mentality in those who remain. While at the same time, the loyal half, quarter, eighth, but probably still really full Jews are looking more and more like their hosts, more and more like us. Peter Sellers, the late actor and comedian from once Great Britain, is an interesting example. Sellers was half Jewish, half English. His looks fall in the range of how an Englishman might look, though perhaps a particularly small and sneaky-looking Englishman. He sounds like an Englishman, too, but there's the amazing thing. He doesn't seem to have a sound that is really his. He's always playing someone. Some of his friends even said that about him. He can sound like an Oxford Don, a Cockney laborer, a French detective, or anything else he chooses to sound like. And even, to some extent, look like. I know that that's what actors do, but in Sellers this mimicry approaches the supernatural. In the text version of this broadcast on nationalvanguard.org, I'll embed a 1980 interview with Sellers by the Jew Gene Shalit on the NBC network, in which Time magazine is quoted as saying, quote, There is no Peter Sellers. There is only a mass of characterizations, close quote. When Sellers does a voice, it's more than a voice. His gestures and even the contours of his face and the expression of his eyes change. He is the character he has assumed. Sellers told an interviewer once how he prepares to do a character. It almost sounds like he can read the character's thoughts and personality through analyzing his voice, face, and body language. Quote, I start with a voice. I find out how the character sounds. It's through the way he speaks that I find out the rest about him. After the voice comes the looks of the man. I do a lot of drawings of the character I play. Then I get together with the makeup man and we sort of transfer my drawings onto my face. An involved process. After that, I establish how the character walks. Very important, the walk. And then suddenly, something strange happens. The person takes over. The man you play begins to exist. Close quote. Can non-Jews do that? Sellers performed the trick, famously, in the comedy film Dr. Strangelove, one of Dr. William Pierce's favorites, by the way, in which he plays three separate parts quite convincingly. Another feat of mimicry was his role as the low-life Cockney villain in The Wrong Arm of the Law from 1963. Whose front is pretending, quite convincingly, to be a French fashion designer. To see and hear Sellers switch almost instantly from Parisian sophisticate to slum-dwelling London thug, sometimes with no change of camera shot or costume, is a revelation of the power of a master mimic. I'll embed a sample of that film, too. Interesting graphic in the film poster you'll see in the embedded thumbnail, by the way. Peter Sellers controlling all the characters like puppets on strings. Talk about anti-Semitic stereotypes. It's revealing, isn't it, that Jews almost always think images of puppeteers controlling people are anti-Jewish stereotypes. I have to believe it's the Jewish component in Sellers that we're seeing here. That component also captured his loyalty, though his parents sent him to a Catholic school. He strongly identified with his Jewish side, and even once said quite passionately, if unrealistically, that total eradication of anti-Semitism was one of his main purposes in life. An extreme example of the chameleonic nature of the apex parasite was revealed to us just yesterday. In this case, a Jewess in the U.S. who actually, successfully, and evidently without makeup except maybe some dark lipstick and black hair dye, posed as a black person for decades and even made a career of her blackness. Peter Sellers has nothing on this creature, that's for sure. Here's what the UK's Guardian newspaper had to say about it. Quote, Jessica Krug, an activist who teaches African American history, writes Medium post apologizing for false identity. A seasoned activist and professor of African American history at George Washington University has been pretending to be black for years, despite actually being a white woman from Kansas City. Well, let me break in and say she's not white. She's Jewish. But Goyish readers aren't supposed to make that kind of distinction, so we'll let it pass for the moment. Back to the article. In a case eerily reminiscent of Rachel Dolezal, Jessica A. Krug took financial support from cultural institutions such as the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture for a book she wrote about fugitive resistance to the transatlantic slave trade. And I'll break in again and say, that's ironic, considering how Jews basically ran that slave trade. Back to the article. But according to a Medium post allegedly written by Krug herself, her career was rooted in a toxic soil of lies. To an escalating degree over my adult life, I have eschewed my lived experience as a white Jewish child in suburban Kansas City under various assumed identities within a blackness that I had no right to claim. First, North African blackness, then U.S.-rooted blackness, then Caribbean-rooted Bronx blackness, she wrote. Let me break in to say, isn't that amazing? She could change her lies, totally, mutually contradictory lies, from year to year, and yet they were all actually believed by supposedly intelligent and educated academics, and also by actual blacks. And not just any blacks, but blacks who made their race their profession and center of their lives. It's like hypnotism, dead serious hypnotism. Back to the Guardian piece. In Krug's book, Fugitive Modernities, published before her confession, she writes in her acknowledgments, "My ancestors, unknown, unnamed, who bled life into a future they had no reason to believe could or should exist. My brother, the fastest, the smartest, the most charming of us all. Those whose names I cannot say for their own safety, whether in my barrio, in Angola, or in Brazil." Come on, let me break in. Blacks in Angola and Brazil are in fear of having their names spoken? What a hoax within a hoax. How can anyone believe this dribble? Back to the article. Krug went by the name Jessica La Bombolera in activist circles and could be seen speaking in a New York City public hearing on police brutality in June, where she said, "I'm Jessa Bombolera." Let me break in again. What a cartoonish, almost mocking name. Back to the quote. "I'm here in El Barrio, East Harlem. You probably have heard about it because you sold my effing neighborhood to developers and gentrifiers," she begins as she introduces herself. A few moments later, she adds, "I want to call out all these white New Yorkers who waited 4 hours with us to be able to speak and then did not yield their time for black and brown indigenous New Yorkers." Let me break in again. What chutzpah! Who controls New York City real estate? Krug's tribe, of course. Back to the article. Krug alludes in her Medium post to a traumatic childhood and mental health issues, but says she does not believe they can be used to excuse her behavior. "To say that I clearly have been battling some unaddressed mental health demons for my entire life, as both an adult and child, is obvious. Mental health issues likely explain why I assumed a false identity initially as a youth, and why I continued and developed it for so long. But mental health issues can never, will never, neither explain nor justify, neither condone nor excuse, that in spite of knowing and regularly critiquing any and every non-black person who appropriates from black people, my false identity was crafted entirely from the fabric of black lives," she wrote. Close quote. Unbelievable. How many others like Krug are out there, embedded in this community and that, controlling and influencing, guiding this or that community in certain preferred directions. Of course, they're embedded right out in the open, on a huge scale, in our community, the white community, the community that dares not speak its name. White people are so trusting, so kind, and so easily duped by the world's master mimics and liars and parasites that they accept the Jew as a variety of white person, perhaps a white person especially deserving of solicitude and help and respect, more than one's own family, certainly. For it's proper for one to countenance criticism of the members of one's own family. One can even disown them and disassociate themselves from them under certain circumstances. But whites, good whites anyway, condemning, disowning, and disassociating from Jews, it's simply not done. The measure of one's worth, and often net worth, is how well one serves these special, oppressed, deserving God people. For some, that's just how bad it is. The mimic and parasite is very, very, very good at what he does. But I believe that millions are not hypnotized. Millions more are ready to have the spell broken. Organized, we can change the course of history and remove the engorged ticks from our necks, their mandibles from our brain stems. Spread the word. Help us reach another million this month. Support the National Alliance.
You're listening to Resolution Radio, Radio, Radio. ResolutionRDO.com.
My brothers, my sisters, I bring you a message of solidarity, a call to action, and a demand for adherence to duty of an Aryan resurgence and ultimately total Aryan victory. We have broken the chains of Jewish thought. We know not the meaning of the word mine, it is ours. Our race, the totality of our people. 10 hearts, one beat. 100 hearts, one beat. 10,000 hearts, one beat. We are born to fight and to die and to continue the flow. The flow of our people. Onward we will go, onward to the stars, high above the mud of yellow, black, and brown. So kinsmen, duty calls. The future is now. If months from now you have not yet fully committed yourself to the alliance, then you have in effect not only betrayed your race, you have betrayed yourself. So stand up like men and drive the enemy into the sea. Stand up like men and swear a sacred oath upon the green graves of our sires that you will reclaim what our forefathers discovered, explored, conquered, settled, built, and died for. Stand up like men and reclaim our soil. Kinsmen, arise. Look towards the stars and proclaim our destiny. Defeat never, victory forever.
We are the American Freedom Party. This is the most urgent time in the history of Western civilization. In the year 1900, white people of European descent comprised 35% of the world population. Today it is less than 9% and falling fast. Europe is being overrun with Middle Eastern immigrants, and America's founding stock is rapidly being replaced with third world peoples from around the globe. For the last 50 years, every influential institution in this nation, our schools and universities, our media, our churches and our employers, have promoted policies and principles that teach whites to be ashamed of their great heritage and birthright. We, who in the 1950s, the 1960s, and 1970s were the world's dominant force, are now so afraid of being called racist that we were quailing towards irrelevance and extinction. Join the American Freedom Party today. Reach us at theamericanfreedomparty.us or call us at 701-317-5317. Paid for by the American Freedom Party.
Water is the single most important thing your body needs, so you want to be sure it's the best for you and your family. Since 2005, thousands have depended on Berkey Purified Water. The Berkey guy provides the lowest priced filtration systems in every size. For incredibly delicious water now and in an emergency, get to GoBerkey.com or call 877-886-3653. 877-886-3653. GoBerkey.com.
What would your life be like if you woke up each morning with new vitality, feeling better than you have in years, and you noticed a difference in your sleeping patterns, blood sugar levels, and had a sense of well-being overall? There's something that is changing thousands of people's lives, and you could be one of them. It's called Heart and Body Extract. Sharon Harris, co-creator of Heart and Body Extract, talks about the positive effects of Heart and Body Extract.
What happens with the formula Heart and Body Extract is it's giving the body the necessary vitamins, minerals, amino acids, enzymes, and phytonutrients so the body will heal itself. And yes, the body does have the ability to balance blood pressure, balance cholesterol, clean and unclog the arteries. It can also work on balancing the circulation for diabetics. So the body is an amazing thing. It simply needs some help so it has the tools to heal itself.
Heart and Body Extract gets results. To order your 2-month supply, call now, toll free at 866-295-5305. Order online at hbextract.com.
I believe in race. I'm not ashamed to admit it at all. And that doesn't mean one bit that I'm out to persecute or hurt any man because of his race. He can't help what race he is. We believe that each race has particular geniuses and particular faults. The white race has built white Western civilization, and we think the white race should dominate in that area. National socialism fundamentally is the application of science not only to inanimate objects and animals, but to mankind himself. We believe that the communists, the Marxists, have one fatal error in their doctrine, a place where absolutely there's a hole and there's no explanation for it. They admit evolution. They admit that animals vary by breed and that you can breed better and worse animals. Now, how do they explain how there is a certain dividing line when you come to one particular animal called man? They have no explanation. Time and again, when I've asked them, they have no explanation. They just say, if it's got two legs and it stands on its hind feet, then it suddenly becomes a special being and there is absolute equality. They're all the same. Man is an animal just like all the rest of the animals. He's more intelligent, but he must obey nature's laws. And that insofar as he is an animal, he must obey the laws that pertain to animals. We say that when the white race has produced such a wonderful thing as Western civilization, we should treasure the people that have produced that and can maintain it. And we should not mix them all up with other kinds of civilizations, whether or not they're good. We should certainly try to preserve it just the way the farmer preserves his better grade of stock. We are also, socially speaking, tribalists. You must live as social beings. You have to live with other people. And this is impossible unless you observe certain fundamental laws of the tribe, the ancient Indian tribe, any kind of tribe of people, even a wolf pack, has got to have certain fundamental things. One of these things is leadership. Not leadership by the most popular, but by the strongest and the best. Any tribe or Indian tribe or any group or family should be led by the best and the strongest. Otherwise, it disintegrates. It's got to have group pride and loyalty. You've got to have selection in the mating process, something that we have almost lost now. We believe that it is of fundamental importance to society that the strongest, cleverest, and the best of the men mate with the best type of women who will make good mothers. And when you destroy that machinery, you get what we have now. We believe that you have got to have an organic society. Now, by an organic society, we mean a society, not a dictatorship, but a society in which the parts of the society cooperate together in different functions and in peace and harmony, just the way your body works. Cancer is the wild, uncontrolled growth of cells at the expense of all the rest of the body, and that's what you have in Washington, D.C. right now. Cancer. We believe in private property and free enterprise. It is impossible, we believe, to have a society in which there is any real work going on unless people can get the reward of their effort. And at the same time, we believe you've got to have social justice. You cannot have people who are exploiting and squeezing little helpless people economically. And this is where I get in trouble with the conservatives, because most of today's conservatives, I've discovered, are reactionaries. They're real anxious to hold on to their money. They don't care how they have to figure it out. They just want those money bags. And they come up with any kind of rationale to keep it. Every national socialist believes in idealism, believes in something that is worth more than his own one single human life. He's willing to die for something. When you're ready to die for something, then you're alive. And until you are ready to die for something, you have no real fanaticism. And just at dinner a little while ago with some of the fellows there, they said, were telling me, well, it's terrible to be a fanatic. Well, did you ever stop and think how this country got here? How all the great inventions ever got there? Any one of you out there that is not a fanatic on something or other, whatever it is you're studying, if you're going to be a doctor, be a fanatical doctor. Otherwise, you'll be nothing. You'll just be an ordinary old chug-chugging guy, and when you die, nobody will notice it. But if you're a fanatic, you'll produce something great. You'll create. Creativity is fanaticism. Every creative genius has had to be a fanatic. Many of them have been burned at the stake. So we are ideological and idealistic fanatics. Just like the communists, by the way. In between the Nazis and the communists is the great mass of non-fanatics. The TV watchers, and the comic book readers. I will say this. National socialism is the inevitable end product, logically, of evolution. If you believe in evolution, you've got to be a Nazi if you think about it long enough. You can't help it. But what happens is people short-circuit it. The minute they believe in evolution and scientific breeding until they come to that two-legged animal that stands up on its hind legs, then all the rules are off. We say that's not possible. You either believe in the scientific method and the truth, and you apply it to yourself without egotism, or else you don't believe in the scientific method and you're kidding yourself. Nazis believe in ruthless application of the truth, not only to inanimate matter and animals, but to you animals. People, all of us are the same insofar as we are animals and must survive and live as animals. And unless we breed ourselves better, we're going to get worse. That's what's happening. I do worship nature in that I'm humble. When I see the mighty, awesome power of nature, and believe me, I've seen some terrific power of nature, the typhoons off Japan during the war, earthquakes. I've been through some tremendous cataclysms on this earth. And compared to them, the atomic bomb is like a firecracker, nothing. And when you start to think of the enormity of space, our spacemen are just going around at the very bottom levels of space. They're no place yet. There are over 100 million planets where life, just like here, could exist. And in the face of that awesome probability, not possibility, probability, I say it's ridiculous to be egocentric and say we are the center of all things. Everything turns around us. We Nazis are humble. When I look at nature and realize how ignorant and small and feeble and weak and little we are, Nazism is a philosophy of nature, a way of looking at the world. And as I pointed out, we believe in tribalism. We don't think we're above that. We think that you've got to have pride in your family, pride in your race, pride in your nation. That's not something to laugh at. Patriotism and pride in family and pride in race is something we should be proud of and cultivate, work on, not get rid of. Finally, we believe in morals. We believe in the traditions of goodness, virtue. Now, I told you something about what we are, but I'll do as good as I can in telling you what I think our enemies are. And our enemies, make no mistake about it, are the Marxists. The philosophy of Marxism, I believe, is the enemy of all humanity. It's the reverse of humanity. We say communism itself is the most vicious, anti-social doctrine the world has ever known, and here's why. They completely deny the very basis on which any human order can exist at all. Without humans, or at least without civilized humans, you certainly can't have human order. And the communists say they don't believe in race. They believe in absolute equality. The pygmies, the aborigines of Australia, everybody. Send them, let them all come to Carlton, and they'll all write arias and books. And the cannibals will be producing the music and verses. That's all you have to do is educate them. And this simply is not true. This results in chaos, social chaos, which is what we have now. They don't believe in enterprise. They don't believe that people should work for themselves. They believe that the state should come and tell them what to do. They don't believe in private property. They don't believe that you can keep the fruits of your production. They don't have, above all, they have no spiritual ideal. We say the only thing that's worth protecting with your life is ideals and your family, your race, and your nation. And twice in my lifetime, I've been called upon to go out and risk getting killed. And I saw a lot of other young men doing this. Young fanatics that they made out of us, by the way. They made us real fanatic haters of the Germans and fanatic haters of the Japanese. Nobody protested that was bad to be a fanatic when we were fighting those Japs, and I assure you, we all were. Finally, the communists, if you remember when they first got into Russia, they are against morals. They had free love, no morals at all, everything was have a ball. And the result was they almost tore Russia to pieces, they just fell apart. Now, if you'll notice, they are almost puritanical in Russia. In order to make the thing work, they've had to go back to the very principles of tribalism which we're advocating. You can't work society with a communist pipe dream. Civilization is based on self-sacrifice, on the willingness of men to go out and die for what they believe in. When you get rid of that self-sacrifice, you get anarchy. Civilization is built because I am willing to give up something for my family. And the family is willing to give up something in order to have the town succeed. And the town is willing to give up something for the state. can be in business, and the state is willing to give up something so the nation can succeed. Self-sacrifice is the first principle of civilization. Communism has got the fanaticism to destroy you, and it's doing it. And unless you can build up a counter-fanaticism for something you believe in positively, you will be destroyed. You are being destroyed.
Recently, there was a report out that among new babies that were born, this happened last year, minorities were now the majority, that whites were officially the minority.
And they're boasting about it. Khrushchev just said, America's so liberal, they'll never fight. And I think there's a lot of truth to that, but we're going to change that. It won't be quite so liberal. After we've had a chance to make America understand what it is and make it conscious of itself and its greatness and its people, and the white race understand that they're worthy of protecting themselves, that they don't have to keep humbling and downgrading themselves while other races are standing up and saying, look at us, how great we are. We keep saying we're ashamed of ourselves for being white. That's a terrible thing. The thing for each race to do is be proud of itself. And the white people, and the good people of this country, when they finally realize that they can do that without hurting or being obnoxious to anybody else, they will finally become fanatics to survive, to keep this great country going.